January 7th to order. We're going to go a little out of order here to meet people's schedules, trying to be as user-friendly as possible. Colleagues, we're going to start with the informational meeting with Parks and Recreation on the rebalance. After that, we're going to go to public testimony, 1 hour of public testimony on the issues listed here, the different bills. It will be 1 hour only maximum, and you get a couple, 3 minutes to hopefully let us know what you are thinking we should or should not be doing in these various areas, because we're trying to hear from as many people as possible. If there are a lot of people that want to testify, probably not everyone's going to be able to. Even if you come from a long ways away, our goal as co-chairs is to hear from different people on different issues. So if there's 10 people on one issue, we'll probably try and go to someone else on a different issue, just trying to be fair about the process. Fair for us, maybe not fair if you don't get a chance to testify, and I apologize up front for that. But we usually don't give any public testimony in Ways and Means, so those of you that have been in this room before realize this is pretty unusual. It's usually agency heads and doing that sort of thing. So, and hopefully within another few minutes we'll have another senator here, so when we go to work session items we can actually move things along.
But we can do information now.
We can do information now. So with that, why don't we have Ms. Jordan open up and have the parks people come forward. I apologize for surprising by going first, but hopefully that's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Parks and Recreation is here to provide a report to alert you to the potential shortfall in their other funds revenues and their actions that they are taking to mitigate that shortfall in the expenditure plan that you adopted last session.
Thank you, Mr. Webb. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. As Mr. Jordan has pointed out, the purpose of being here this afternoon is to inform you of a shortfall that we are identifying in our budget and our other funds versus lottery revenue. And the shortfall is occurring in the other funds category. We have had some increases in our budget. If you look at the projected salary packages and an increase in DAS service charges that was not projected in the legislatively adopted budget, and a reduction in other fund revenue, which wasn't adjusted in our budget as a result of the Senate bill that changed the distribution of RV registration fees, what is occurring is we have we've identified a shortfall in our other funds budget. And what we plan to do is continue to further analyze this and bring it back to you at a future e-board with a plan on rebalancing it. Right now, we've already implemented some management actions within the agency that will allow us to mitigate the shortfall. Basically, what needs to occur is an adjustment between the fund sources to meet the expenditure shortfalls, and that's what we'll be asking when we come back at a future emergency board. But as I mentioned, we have already in place a plan of action to make some adjustments in our other fund expenditures, and we'll put together a plan for you, a detailed plan of how we would make those adjustments when we come back at a future e-board. Again, I think it's early enough in the biennium. You know, we've discovered this problem about 25% into the biennium. We've implemented some management actions. We've got some time to work with it, and also give us some time to see the results of tomorrow's revenue forecast as it pertains to lottery and any other future lottery forecasts that may come out before we would come back to the emergency board. So, again, my purpose today is to just inform you that we've identified this issue. We're working with Ms. Jordan in LFO and Lisa Pearson in BAM to put together a plan to address it.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Wolf? The only comment I guess I make is I know my co-chair and others are interested that in the salary package, to the extent that some of that has been the result of some of the actions by the executive branch in the last few months, the legislature is hoping to get a report on how the executive branch plans to manage those increases without affecting programs. So to the extent you can help them with that work in your department, that would be very helpful.
Will do.
Thank you. Are there questions, concerns? Seeing none, thank you for that information.
Mr.
Yes.
This is informational, so we don't need to do anything.
Okay, never mind.
All right, now we're going to continue with our change of order and go to public testimony on the Senate Bill 5555, Senate Bill 5556, HB 5100, and House Bill 3626. Oh, there is a sign-up sheet over there on the table by the door. If you would like to do that, then we can look at the list, if you will.
So far, we have one person.
Why don't we start with Esther Preston?
Oops, sorry.
Thank you for traveling quite a ways.
Oh, hi, I'm Esther Preston. I'm from Deschutes County. I take care of my 93-year-old mother. We got her 3 years ago. She was we went up to see her in California. My niece called me and said she needed some help. She weighed 67 pounds. She was malnourished. She was dehydrated. The doctor was amazed that she even made it that far to come up here. And she wanted to be with us. She did not want to go to a nursing home. She's up to 87 pounds. She's very happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had to quit my job and take care of her full time. My husband's retired. He had a medical discharge retirement from the state that he worked for 33 years. But there's no way for me to work full time. We haven't had a raise for her. She's Medicaid. In 3 years, and we've used all our life savings, everything we've saved for. We don't get any respite care, any help. We have a daughter that lives close by. That's the only time that we can get away, like to come to something like this. And we're just asking for you to reconsider some funds for us.
Okay. Thank you.
My name is Arthur Towers, political director for the Service Employees Union Local 503. Just add a couple quick facts. Esther and folks like her get around between $700 and $800 per month to care for their relative. The funds that have been considered to date would not take into account relative providers, but only commercial providers. And the rates have not been increased in 6 years. So thank you very much.
And that's 24-hour care.
Yeah, that's hard.
Thank you. Safe trip home. Thank you.
All right. Let's hear from Mike Mima. I hope I got that right.
Mr. Kocher, which bill are we...
These are on any of the four bills we've got down here that would deal... Frankly, that's pretty much everything, because those bills deal with the entire scope of the budget we'll be dealing with this legislative session.
What we didn't establish then with the previous witnesses, which bill they were testifying.
I assume it was the budget adjustment bill.
I didn't want to assume. I wanted
probably to... a fair point, make Senator clear.
If you know the bill you're testifying on, please let us know. Mm-hmm. Please continue or begin. Okay.
Senator Schrader, Representative Nolan, committee members, I'm here today to talk to you about House Bill 3626.
My name is Michael Mumar.
I am the emergency manager for the city of Beaverton, and today I'm here before you as the president of the Oregon Emergency Management Association. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify. The Oregon Emergency Management Association is a statewide association of individuals who share an interest in the emergency management profession. Our members include local, state, and federal emergency managers, as well as emergency managers from nonprofit organizations in the private sector. OEMA is committed to minimizing the impact of disasters on communities throughout Oregon. The Oregon Emergency Management Association has strong concerns with House Bill 3626, specifically Sections 4, 5, and 6, and how it would negatively impact the ability of local jurisdictions to receive federal funds under FEMA's Pre-Disaster Mitigation Grant Program and the Disaster Public Assistance Process. The current system that the state has in place has proven to be highly effective for managing these pass-through funds and meets federal requirements. Several of our members have been successful in receiving grants under FEMA's Competitive Pre-Disaster Mitigation Grant Program, and others represent jurisdictions that have had presidentially declared disasters and benefited from FEMA's Public Assistance Program. Pre-Disaster Mitigation Program provides funds to states, territories, and federally recognized Indian tribes, governments, and communities for hazard mitigation planning and the implementation of projects to minimize the impacts of disasters. Funding of these plans and projects reduces the overall risks to the population and structures while also reducing reliance on funding from a national disaster declaration. The Pre-Disaster Mitigation Grant is a national competitive program. Public assistance, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, FEMA, through its Public Assistance Grant Program, reimburses state and local governments and certain private nonprofit organizations for the actual costs of work required as a result of a disaster. When the president declares a disaster, based on a request from a governor, the Federal Emergency Management Agency designates the area eligible for the assistance and the types of assistance available, including public assistance. Eligible work under the PA program for a declared disaster is documented on a project worksheet. The project worksheet is used to record a detailed description, the scope of the eligible work, estimated national costs, special considerations associated with the project. FEMA then reviews, approves, and obligates the entire federal share of that project. Once FEMA obligates the funds, they become immediately available for the state to disperse to the applicants. Both programs, as well as all federal grant programs, are governed by federal laws and regulations. Under these laws and regulations, the states do not have the authority over how these funds are expended. The pre-disaster mitigation grants funds are awarded to specific eligible jurisdictions for a specific project and is based on detailed benefit cost analysis. The public assistance funding is awarded and dispersed based on the project worksheet submitted by eligible jurisdictions for eligible damages and costs. There is not a problem with the system that's currently in place at the state for managing and passing through FEMA pre-disaster mitigation funds and funds provided under the public assistance program. The requirements contained in House Bill 3626 will not provide any benefit to the jurisdictions eligible for these funds and will only serve to first establish an additional layer of bureaucracy that will only serve to increase the time it will take eligible jurisdictions to receive their authorized funding, and two, will run contrary to the laws and regulations established by the federal government for the use of these funds, which could threaten the eligibility of all Oregon jurisdictions to receive these funds in the future.
We need you to wrap up.
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's it. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Very good. Good job. Any comments?
Just for the record, my name is Steve West. I'm the executive director of the association.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. West. Thank you guys for your testimony.
Very good job.
Let's get a couple of county commissioners up here, Tony Hyde and Mark Laphart, please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Schrader and Representative Nolan. For the record, I'm Tony Hyde, County Commissioner in Columbia County, and I wish to testify briefly on House Bill or Bill 3626. I know that you have a lot of people that want to speak to you, so I'm going to keep it very short on my part. When we have an emergency, we need to be able to pull the trigger on available funding quickly. To whatever extent that this is going to draw out or has the potential to draw out that ability, I really implore that you pay close attention to that and that we don't add another week, 2 weeks, 6 months to the process. That's really my biggest concern. Money is already sequestered from the federal government. The point is we just need to get it on the street as quick as possible when we have an emergency. So that's really my only testimony on this.
Thank you, co-chairs. My name is Mark Labhart, and I am a Tillamook County Commissioner. And if you know about Tillamook County, we have a lot of experience in disasters and floods. I'll take about a minute of your time to tell you some concerns that I have about House Bill 3626. The executive summary is that there are legitimate concerns about getting funds too quickly to local governments, and that is an issue that is very important to us, particularly when we don't have the dollars to implement on the ground. In our opinion, the federal programs are already well-defined and well thought out with good rules and procedures. This House bill places more burden on the process, which slows the allocation of money to our local jurisdictions, and not only at the county level, but the local level. It's clear in reading the report that the committee has expressed a desire to control spending, which it is your responsibility to control spending. But we need to do that in a way that allows the flexibility for us to be able to get the dollars as quickly as possible on the ground. So there are concerns with 3626. I hope that you take a look at that and remember that we need to get the funds quickly to our local communities so we can address the disasters that come before us. And in Tillamook County, it seems to be on a yearly basis. Thank you for your time.
Thank you guys very much. We'll sustain a testimony. Professionals at it. Inside school. Let's see. Why don't we have Scott Winkles, League of Oregon Cities, come up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Winkles with the League of Oregon Cities, appearing in opposition to Senate House Bill 3626. I will be exceptionally brief on to the excellent panels ahead of me. My initial reaction to House Bill 3626, after reading it and putting some thought into it, was that there may be a problem with it and being out of compliance with CFR Chapter 44, which is the relevant chapter of federal law. I would strongly urge the committee to direct staff to do further review to ensure that that this would in fact be in compliance. Should we be out of compliance, then many local governments across the state will not have access to the much-needed mitigation dollars for possibly even disaster assistance funds.
Very good. Thank you, Scott.
Certainly.
General Caldwell, would you like to come forward?
Double duty here, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, which we are the proud donors and recipients of the Office of Emergency Management in the last legislative session, just in time for the December floods.
Welcome.
So we're having a good time. We too have questions about House Bill 3626. I feel like the fellow who set out to drain the swamp and ended up with alligators around our necks. As you recall, in December I came before you and testified that we would appreciate the ability to have non-limited funds, and that turned into a fairly lengthy debate about the legislative intent and legislative prerogative on non-limited funds. And the reason we asked for those non-limited funds was because of the very thing that happened in December and could very well be facing us here in a few months with respect to disasters and money coming forward from the federal government. We asked for, and it's in the earlier bills, and one of the earlier bills, $11.8 million for spending limitation without those non-limited funds to put essentially federal government money out to the local entities. Yesterday I read a report that we are now somewhere between $60 and $70 million. When we asked for that money in December, $11.8 million, we didn't know quite exactly what this whole thing was going to cost. And now it looks like we're going to be up between $60 and $70 million. So in essence, what we would have is $11.8 million worth of spending authority and $60 to $70 million to put out to local governments. Now, if you folks are in session every day, that probably isn't a big issue, but we all know that isn't the case. So then we've got to stand in the queue, get in the queue, and get through the bureaucratic process to get into the border here into some other functions so we can do that, which needs to be back to the original intent. So we started with this whole discussion, which gives us non-limited funding. I don't have any debate about whether or not the legislature wants to maintain that and give us unlimited or limited subsidies. Certainly your prerogative and constitutional responsibility. We completely concur with that. But we need to be smart enough to raise the lid high enough so we can get that money out to the local entities as quickly and as rapidly as possible. And that's really our objective. That was our objective initially. That's what we set out to do. That's what we came and testified on, and we're hoping that we could do that. I don't think this accomplishes what we're after. And I think, secondly, we just found out later today that the feds may have a problem with some of the language in it, which could then really disrupt what you've heard in previous testimony. So I would recommend that we step back a step and take a look at this and see what we can do to make this thing work. We have the ability now to do everything this bill says within the state financial management system. It's just a question of whether or not it fits the exact desires of what your staff really needs, desires or need, has to have. And we're willing to work with them on that measure. And with that, I will curtail my testimony, and it's always a pleasure to come before this august body. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Yes, Senator Clare has a question.
General, how much time lag has happened between what local jurisdictions need and your ability to respond?
Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, and Vice Chair Carter, I think that, generally speaking, up until this last budget cycle, that lag was very minute because the agency, Office of Emergency Management, had the non-limited funding category, which meant literally as quick as you can run the paperwork when the federal government puts it in, they can pop the checks out to the cities, the counties, the local entities. This is the first time we've had a disaster of any magnitude, and right now, I suspect we'll do fine with getting this money out until we hit that limitation number, and then we're stopped. And so, I think, Ken, maybe you can answer the typical time.
Co-chairs and Vice Chair Carter, Ken Murphy, Director of Oregon Emergency Management, for the record. If everything, stars are aligned, literally, it can run about 5 to 7 days before we can start first getting checks out. And, a lot of that's based upon damage assessments and making sure people are eligible applicants.
Thank you.
We'll look at it, sir.
Okay. One last item that I guess I kind of thought about. Whether it's not limited or not, we're not probably smart enough to know what the next disaster is going to cost or how much federal money is going to come in. Mm-hmm. So I don't want everybody to get wrapped around the axle about the non-limited piece. Right. I think if we can have limited funds, we just got to raise the ceiling high enough so when we get one of these things, we don't end up in a situation and we can buy ourselves time then to come back to you and say, well, we're hitting the $60 million now. Now we're going to have to go for $100 million because that's what's coming in. So some of this is basically on our responsibility to try to figure out and make a good guess, and your staff and DAS to figure out what is that right guess and where is that ceiling should it be. I don't have any problem with that. That's, I don't care if it's limited or non-limited. That's up to you all. But I just think we need to be smart enough that we don't shoot ourselves in the foot when we just don't need to.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We may want to go back and look at that earlier bill where that 11.8 is and push it up.
We'll take a look. Let's see. Why don't we get George Persteiner to come forward, or someone that he would like to have come forward with him, perhaps.
Thank you, Chair Schrader, members of the committee. For the record, I'm George Kernsteiner with the Oregon University System, and I'm joined here by Joe Bell. Now, we wanted to have just a minute to discuss with you the Oregon Institute of Technology's Center for Healthcare Professions. As you know, we've discussed this with you both during the prior session and during the interim, and we're here to ask that you include this project in your capital construction and bond bill in this supplemental session. As you know, new programs in polysomnography, health information technology, healthcare administration, echocardiography are being mounted. We're about to begin to admit students into those programs, and this would be the home. And so we would really hope that you'd be able to include the bonding in there. And I have a letter here from John Day, who's the co-chair of the OIT Capital Campaign, again urging your support for this project.
Thank you. Ms. Bell?
No comments. Joe Bell, I'm just here to answer any questions if you had any.
Very good. Good to see you. Any questions from any of the members? We got a lot of support at our last hearing, and we'll see what happens in our forecast and our capital construction bill, and if we'll be able to make ends meet here. Thank you very much. I Is there anyone else that's come in that would like to testify before we go to the work session on the Oregon Student Assistance Commission? Please come forward and identify yourself for the record.
Chairs, members of the committee, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. I can't speak to the disaster sections of this bill at all, but Section 1 of the bill is completely different and is a fix to House Bill 2901, which was passed last session, impacting or rewriting ORS 295, the collateralization of public fund statutes. And that had an impact on the definition of custodian bank for local government investments. That's in Section 1. It's critical that that piece get fixed. That change doesn't go into effect until July 1 when the 2901 fixes and the new collateral legislation goes into effect. But if that change isn't made, then local governments won't have a place to legally park their investments, and that would be a bad thing. So this is a simple fix. I think it's an absolutely non-controversial fix, but it would be a bad thing to not get fixed. So whether it's this bill or some other bill, that needs to happen.
That's helpful. Thank you very much. Okay, seeing no one else, we're going to recess the public hearing for now and go to work session on Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Thank you for your patience. You were first up and had to wait. It's always interesting hearing what citizens and other people have to say, right?
Yeah.
Let's start with staff. Some information for us, Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The Oregon Student Assistance Commission is coming before you today with a report on the implementation of the shared responsibility model changes to the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. The reason they are here is in their budget, you included a budget note directing them to come back and report on the progress toward implementing the model. They will be doing that and speaking about both the actions they have taken in order to assure that the shared responsibility model awards will be available for students beginning in the fall, and also talk a bit about the award levels that are coming to pass under the changes that you approved. I would like to point out before they start that I have distributed a handout to you. It's a set of three charts that are basically summarizing some of the changes to the Opportunity Grant Program that will be happening as a result of the increase in funding that the legislature provided for the shared responsibility model, and as a result of the parameters and decisions that the Oregon Student Assistance Commission adopted in determining how that model would be implemented. Some of these, just some of the basic points to note, is that funding for opportunity grants is more than doubling next year. It will increase by 117% over last year. The amount that funding is increasing is varying by the different institutions. Funding is increasing by 110% for community college students, by 149% for OUS and OHSU students, and by 38% for students at private colleges. The second chart of these three clarifies what's happening in terms of the number of awards that will be granted and what's happening in terms of the average size of the award that will be granted. Overall, the program is expected to expand the number of students being served by 24% over current levels. The increases vary. Community college participation is basically going to be at current levels. It's estimated to be up 1.4% from current levels. At the Oregon University System and OHSU, participation or grant awards are expected to increase by 48%. And at private institutions, the number of students will almost double. There will be projected to be an 87% increase in the number of students. And the last chart indicates the size of the grant, average grant amounts. In overall terms, average grant size will increase by about 76% for students who are receiving grants under this program. Now, a little more than double on average for community college students, up 108%. increased by about 70% for students in the four-year public sector, and there will be a decrease in the average award amounts by about 25% for students of private colleges. Any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I think the institution has a report.
Sarah, what's the next question?
The commission has a report.
Thank you, Chair Schrader. Mr. Bender, in the model proposed during the 2007 session...
Speak up just a little bit.
In the model proposed during the 2007 session, the maximum award would have been $5,600, and now we're at $3,200. Was the model that far off, or was the was it changed significantly by the legislative imposed cap of $72 million?
The model, when it was known that funding would be approximately $72 or $73 million, the governor's office and agency brought forth a proposal that was designed to cost be within that cost range, and at that time it was assumed, or the best estimates were, that some awards could be funded that would be at the $5,600 level. There weren't going to be a lot of them under the proposal, but that was the way that the proposal was brought forward during the 2007 session. During the 2007 session, LFO, for one, expressed concerns to the subcommittee that we were concerned that the model that was being brought forward really would not cost $72 million, and that would be necessary to make cutbacks in award sizes or in eligibility in order to keep the model within the funding level. It did turn out that on further analysis, the commission found that it was true that the award amounts that had been discussed during the session would have cost well more than $72 million to implement, and they did make a number of adjustments in order to ensure a program that was within budget. One of the adjustments that they made was to limit the maximum award size. There were a number of different adjustments in the analysis which I distributed. I spoke of some of the major adjustments that were approved by the commission in order to keep the cost from being beyond $72 million. I believe that the commission will be able to give you more information on the monetary impact of some of these changes in order to bring back the total cost to $72 million. But the legislature instructed the agency to change the parameters of the program in order to maintain the cost within $72 million. They have done so, and one of the instruments that they used was to limit award amounts.
Mr. Bender, I applaud that action. I was just questioning the original model that was apparently off by a little more than 40%, and wondering was that a model generated by the public sector? Was that a paid for model? I mean, how did we come to that?
I do believe that the agency can speak further on this. The agency of the Oregon University System hired a consultant to model the shared responsibility model and to make projections of costs. And this model clearly underprojected the costs of what the program would be to implement. And we did have concerns about that during the session. And as a result of those concerns, this committee directed the commission to make the adjustments that would be necessary to keep the program within the budget.
Thank you, Mr. Bender.
Well, further questions, staff? I'm sure some of these questions will be probably answered in their presentation.
Yeah.
All right. Please proceed, Mr. Johnson.
Good afternoon, Coach Schrader, Coach Nolan, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dennis Johnson with the Student Assistance Commission. And what you see before you on the screen, I'm hoping it will stay up there, is also what appears in your report, I think six pages from the back, as a hard copy of what we call a console page, the overall summary of what we project awards to look like, the total roll-up cost of these awards, under our current assumptions. Now, many assumptions need to be made, but we first start with the things that you have heard about, that you're familiar with. This program It was designed by a consultant, and the effort came out of a statewide effort, the Access and Affordability Work Group. It was funded by the Board of Higher Education, and it was a cooperative effort by the entire higher education community. So everyone knew when the model was delivered, it was a simulation, and it used data, in some cases from several years ago, in some cases data that was simply available no other way than to impute from surveys. So the consultant with the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education presented a recommendation for how this model might work and populated the model with data that was not representative of Oregon students' behavior necessarily. What we were able to do then during the session and through the summer, knowing that this looked to be to become a reality, what we were able to do was build the infrastructure so that we can actually project based on real student behavior. For example, this is only the second academic year that we have results from students who have been enrolled part-time. Only have the second year now of statistics, real student behavior, how many go part-time, how many go full-time by sector. So we now have real data that we can plug into this kind of model. We now have a real projection model, and using the completed academic year, 06-07, we've been able to project what a similar population of students would look like. Now, so you don't think this is something that varies a good deal. Every year at the Commission, we get 160,000 federal applications for the free application for federal student aid, or the FAFSA form. Of those, about 110,000 or so are what I would call viable candidates for this program. They're undergraduate Oregon residents planning to attend an Oregon school. And then, of course, they have to match the program requirements, which we change with this new model. So we will be assisting students we have not been assisting before, and we are imputing their behavior, if you will. Looking at this summary, you will see in the second category, the student share, that we assume a full-time student to be at an equivalent of 1.0 and a half-time student to be at an equivalent of 0.5. That's important because some early information frightened people. It got people concerned that halftime awards were going away. They never went away. But in the original model, it is true, halftime awards would have been curtailed severely. So the steering committee, the commission, taking all of this input into account, worked with the governor's staff, worked with the entire higher education community, came up with an adjustment, a revision. And halftime awards now are close to half of what a full-time award would be. And that's what that implies. Under the other variables section here, something that's very important is that we rely on, in this model, on federal funding. We need to know how much Pell Grants a student is going to receive. The Pell Grant program, the federal Pell Grant program, is the largest single financial aid program in the country. It's an entitlement program, and until this current academic year, the maximum Pell Grant had been $4,050. The minimum had been $400. This academic year, the maximum was raised to $4,310. Minimum stayed at $400. What we learned over the holidays, when budget reconciliation for the higher education funding for programs funded for higher education, when that became reality, we learned that the maximum this year would not be the $4,800 we had been assuming, we had been hearing all through the summer and the fall. It would be instead $4,731. Well, that lopped $69 off the maximum award for a lot of our needy students. And then not only that, but the federal minimum, which had been at $400 for the better part of a decade, would be increased to $890. So we scrambled, went back, redid all the projections, and you see the results here. When you look at the estimated results, the last category, you see something coming in just under $72 million. That's our not-to-exceed number. And the reason we have a little bit of a cushion there is because we will have grandfathered awards. As Mr. Bender mentioned, not all student awards go up in the independent college sector. Some of the maximum awards go down, but for the students currently enrolled in receiving higher awards, if they stay continuously enrolled, they'll have a grandfathered award amount. They will get that award until they complete their undergraduate programs. For the next 3 to 4 years, then, we will have a declining balance of grandfathered awards. Overall, the awards go up. The recipients go up. The number of students we expect to assist in this program this year is 27,000 or so. Any way we look at it, our projections take us to a level of about 34,000 students. So out of that universe of 110,000 or so undergraduates, Oregon students, we will be assisting a third or more. The awards, which now are an all-or-nothing award, if you know the campus that a student is attending, you can say what that very needy student must be getting in an opportunity grant. Next year, they will vary then from $400 up to $2,600 at a community college, up to $3,200 at a four-year school. To help students with this, we have been promoting an estimator, because students won't know how much they can get unless they have a helpful tool. And we rolled this tool out in November, made the necessary adjustments over the holidays when we found the correct number or amounts for Pell Grants were going to vary. And we've had this as a tool to help us recruit, advise, challenge students, if you will, to think about their futures next year, to think about what is going to be available to assist them reach their goals, in reaching their goals. And in a few screens, we can take a student through to an estimate. This information is all in your packet, of course, or the report from us, but this is maybe the most important thing, because if a student has filled out the free application for federal student aid, that FAFSA form, by the way, it's an onerous one. It's worse than a 1040. It's extremely long. It takes almost an expert to walk a family through it. But once we get a student to that point, we know the two bits of information that we need to tell that student what her or his opportunity grant will be for next year. And the estimates then are given on this final screen. You see here an estimate of a student who would receive a Pell Grant of $4,200 and an opportunity grant of more than $2,900. That's a very powerful message for a student and for a family to receive. We've had over 10,000 hits on this estimator so far. And I would refer you to some of the cases in our report to just give you examples of what students can be expected to receive at various income levels, students from various family types. Equally as powerful is that we have been sending, since the beginning of January now, emails to all students who submit that FAFSA form and appear to be eligible. Now, I say appear to be because the information is always subject to change and correction with students, but if that information holds, we feel very confident that student will be getting a grant in the fall. Now, in the past...
Pardon me, Ms. John. Question, Senator Wardley.
Thank you. What is that number of students that have completed the FAFSA? What is that number?
Chair Schrader, Senator Wardley, to date it is, well, this is as of yesterday, 38,813. And out of that number, this is only early February, and students will be applying throughout the whole next 16 months or so. As of yesterday, we had sent messages of potential eligibility, the message you see on your screen and in your report, to 16,141 students. It's not half, And if it were half, we'd be even more concerned. But we will be monitoring this very, very carefully, you can imagine, through the spring and through the summer. What we are trying to do here is to change student behavior. In the past, students would not have learned about their eligibility until they got an AID award, and that might not come from the college until late spring, early summer. We have some shameful pickup rates in this state. And by that I mean students fill out that onerous form, that FAFSA, and don't show up for college in the fall. They go through part of the process, but we don't know what happens. Either they don't gain admission, they aren't known by the colleges and universities, they don't follow through with the application process. My hunch is most of them just go part of the way and get discouraged. And if we can tell them early on how much they might qualify to receive, it can change their behavior.
An additional question, follow-up. The 10,000 hits that you mentioned, is that 10,000 part of the 16,141?
Senator Co-Chair Schrader, Senator Gordley, the 10,000 could be entirely separate, but I'm sure there is substantial overlap. We can't tell because we don't ask them when they fill out the estimator for any identifying information. We don't want them to feel like they're filling out some kind of official form. They're filling out an estimate based on information that could change for them. And for some families, this might mean filling it out in January, doing their taxes in February or March, filling it out again, and they will find out that, yes, that extra $5,000 in income did make a difference, you know, those kinds of things. So the power of this, though, is what it does for people at the margins, I think. We had a very successful event at the end of January called College Goal Oregon, where at 20 sites around the state, we had a blitz effort, financial aid professionals from all around the state working on those sites to help people excuse me, fill out that form. And I worked at the Lane Community College site. We had over 102 families go through our computer center there and fill out the form, and then I would walk them through the estimator. How powerful for a student who doesn't think that she can go on to college in the fall to realize, even if I go part-time, I've got enough money to handle tuition and maybe books, and suddenly it's a reality. So those are very powerful things. We know they are because the emotions came out. There were tears of joy when people found out how much they're eligible to receive. Finally, I would like to draw your attention here to what has gone into getting us to this point. I'm not going to bore you with the steps, but this is the seventh page from the back of your report. It's attachment one. There's that budget note that tells us we must report. Well, I'm happy to report that everything has been ahead of schedule. The infrastructure has been built. The estimator has been working. The students are getting the messages, and the applications are flooding in. We will know more by March. When a lot of colleges and universities have their deadline, we'll know, are we way ahead of schedule this year? Are we simply on schedule, or are we behind? We don't like to use the R word, but were the economy to go into a tailspin, we could expect that delayed counter-cyclical effect. More people go back to school when there's a recession. I'm not hoping for one. None of us want one, but there is always that possibility that we could have more students showing up because the economy goes bad. The details I can certainly fill you in on. The final sheet here says in the last three rows that we are reporting to you as of today. We will be dispersing the first of these awards in September. However, we've already begun posting awards for campus financial aid officers. We have tools that we've specially built that are kind of behind the curtain tools. So financial aid officers can log on, find out how many students have indicated their campuses to have those federal forms sent to, what's the eligibility for all those students? And then if they come up with students who aren't on their lists, they can instantaneously find out what the award levels would be at halftime or full-time for those new students. And, of course, we will have reporting by next fall. In the meantime, there are those cost controls that we could manipulate, and we will be, you can be sure, working with governor's staff, with the steering committee, and with our commission to recommend what adjustments, if we need to, whittle later awards down a bit to stay within budget.
Thank you very much. Let's see. Excuse me, Senator Johnson. Apologize.
Two questions. Thank you for your report. The first one is, when you talked about making this first round of distributions, what's the mechanics behind the check? Let's say I'm going to the university. I was about to say OSU, at the University of Oregon, and I've gotten an award, and somewhere along the line, a check transfers. Does the money come to Betsy Johnson, and then I'm responsible for paying the university, or does it go to the university to my account, or how does that work?
Co-chair, Senator Johnson, the whole process is relatively invisible for the student. What happens is that a student, let's take it from the beginning, applies for admission, applies for financial aid, gains admission, and gets a financial aid award from the university. And that financial aid award has a number of elements on it. We may have six or eight different fund sources, two of which don't have to be paid back, that federal Pell Grant and the Oregon Opportunity Grant. If the student accepts that aid award and returns it, and that's usually done electronically now with a PIN and an electronic transmission of that aid award back to the aid office, then the school prepares the student account. And what we do is advance. It's almost like a line of credit for that university. Based on past history and on all the students that we know who have applied for that particular university, we advance them a line of credit. The funds are all transmitted electronically and credited to the student's account. So the student arrives on campus, if she has accepted that aid award, you know, and done everything she needed to do. Perhaps a tax return was required to verify something, but if everything is complete, by the time the student gets there, the funds have been credited to her account, and she will either owe the balance or will have a rebate check coming back. If she's a commuter student, perhaps there's money coming back to pay for books and for off-campus room and board.
I'm just trying to see the accountability piece of this. Let's assume there's a rebate coming back. What are the accountabilities to know that, in fact, that was spent on room and board or on books? And what happens if I have some kind of a credit in my account and I withdraw from school for whatever reason and go off to work in France? What happens to that money?
Senator Schroeder, Senator Johnson, each campus has to have federally mandated policies for refunds and rebates, and they have to meet minimum federal guidelines, in other words. At the beginning of each term, there's a period that is quite fluid. Students are adding and subtracting courses, and there's a mandated add-drop date, which kind of freezes the enrollment. Beyond that point, a student would lose, there would be no refunds. Up to that point, refunds are usually tiered. If you withdraw within the first day or two, there's a 100% refund, and 100% of the funds would go back to each account in the proportion that they've been given. So if a student's award has half the funds coming from one source, that half would go back to that account. And if that source happened to be the Opportunity Grant, we would get all the money back. But it declines. As the semester or quarter goes on, you might go from 100 to 90 to 70 to 50%. And the proportion then is returned to each account that I described in that award letter. So there is, you know, correct. If everyone is following the policies, there's very little potential for abuse because the funds are returned. It's, of course, a very small minority of students who don't use the funds. There are those students who are constantly in flux, adding and dropping courses for the first few weeks of any term. We would hope that this sends them a powerful message. You need to be above the 12-credit minimum to be considered full-time for federal and for state funds. That would be the assumption, you know, that we're operating under. If you drop down to 11 credits, you're going to lose a big portion of your assistance. So there is motivation for students to keep up their enrollment level.
One last question.
Yes, please.
How much money have you spent at this point with consultants and administrative overhead to build the charts that you're sharing with us today?
Coach Schroeder, Senator Johnson, we at the Commission have had very little direct investment, less than $100,000 spent on computer programming for this. The consultant was not paid for by the Commission, so I can't tell you what that investment was. It happened before the bill was passed, before we got the new model. But from our side, we have several staff positions now, net addition of a couple that are devoted to this, but the actual programming, and we hired somebody specially to do this over the summer and into the fall, actually far less than $100,000. It was probably in the $50,000 to $60,000 range to program it. The reason we couldn't take this on a year ago is because we were still in what is in information technology terms kind of a dark age. We were using a mainframe computer and everything was programmed in COBOL. We were at that time completing a transition to a much more modern SQL Server based system. Everything is programmed in Visual Basic and state of the art. It allows for instantaneous transmission of these data and for projections that are far more accurate and far faster. By the time we got the bill, Senate Bill 334, we were ready to take this on. It had the infrastructure, and it took a little bit of staffing to beef up our staffing dedicated to this and prepare. Now, I just got word that the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, the consultant is affiliated with WICHE, that was about $40,000 a state investment, and that would be a one-time investment, of course. And our programming, the extra staff that we hired over the summer are no longer with us. That staff was a one-time investment. Now we have the net addition of, I think, a couple.
Thank you. So many of us are so shell-shocked that we expect computer programming and computer implementation to run in the multiple millions for you to be under $100,000. If we look stunned, it's because the number's too low.
Say that, Senator.
Senator Carter. This is a fine example for other agencies.
Yes, it is.
Senator Carter.
Thank you. Can you tell me, when students apply for this program, do you take their grade point average from high school, or is there an expected GPA at a particular time? How does that work?
Coach Schroeder, Senator Carter, this is a purely need-based program. So if the student meets the admission requirements of the college or university and then the financial requirements of the program, the student may receive the grant. The student has to maintain satisfactory academic progress, but that's defined by the community college or the four-year college.
Very good.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Edwards and Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Johnson, in the 2007 session, this program was premised on the notion that by developing need-based grants, students who worked a minimum of somewhere between 12 and 15 hours a week if they were full-time would essentially have their college education paid for them. Is that premise threatened at all by the caps that have now been instituted? I'm trying to square that premise with the imposition of caps.
Mm-hmm. co-chairs, Representative Edwards, very good question. Of course, none of us like to see the caps because that reduces what the neediest students we get. One note of reassurance, the very neediest students don't have their awards reduced from those levels of 3,200 or 2,600. We use a factor that we multiply times the student's family contribution, and of course any number multiplied by zero is still zero. So those students, we're not subtracting any additional family contribution. I look at it this way. The maximum grant for a four-year student is $3,200. Mm-hmm. The maximum Pell Grant, that student getting $3,200 should probably get a full Pell Grant, too. That's $4,700.
Mm-hmm.
And that's $8,000 worth of gift assistance, money that doesn't have to be paid back. That's darn near 50% of the cost of a four-year college or university, 1 year. That applies to all of the seven OUS universities, certainly. The $2,600 and the $4,700 at a community college, that's a lot of money going back to that student. I mean, free money that doesn't have to be paid back, going back to that student for room and board, and most community college students have to live on their own somewhere if they've relocated. So, you know, an apartment, very few dormitories at community colleges. So it's an enormous boost for the full-need students. And, of course, the awards tier down from $3,200 all the way down to $400, $26 down to $400 the same. But it's that overall positive message of lots more assistance. That $3,200 level, the $2,600 level, those are double what we were awarding as maximum awards in the OUS sector and the community college sector just a year ago. So,
and the minimum wage discussion about working minimum wage full-time summer, 10 to 15 hours school year,
mm-hmm.
was predicated on the student paying about 50% of his or her own way to the system. Follow-up, please.
On that note, Mr. Chair, what percentage on average then do we expect a recipient to be paying for a college education? Is it still around 50% or 45%, or is it higher than that due to the caps and the need to readjust the model?
Co-Chair Schroeder, Representative Edwards, I don't have a percentage on what that would be, but we could work backwards from that and get you that information. It's a very straightforward thing to do. Once again, what I would remind you of, though, is that we're looking at a very standard amount. This standard four-year budget is not going to meet the situation for an independent student who has to pay for all of her or his own health insurance and transportation and everything else. It can't possibly be included. Similarly, It's a standard in that it is reasonable for the state of Oregon. At a public campus, it doesn't meet the expenses for an independent college or university. So I would encourage us to look, I guess, at what we're doing for the neediest students and how we are able to, for the first time, reach up to families in that $70,000 adjusted gross income level. This year, a family of four, if you made $32,000 or $33,000, you got zero. Mm-hmm. And next year, up to $70,000, that same family would get some assistance through the program. So it's a matter of spreading the funds around a great deal more and targeting, reaching the needy at the same time. Perhaps no problem can program could reach all, make all the goals in the first year, but it's an enormous step and a huge investment for the state, and I believe we're on the right track with it.
Follow up? Just a quick comment, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, I appreciate the magnitude of the program and agree with the structure, especially compared to what's gone before. I'm just simply trying to better understand the differential between what was presented to us in the 2007 session and what we're faced with now, given the adjustments to the model in the interim.
Well, these adjustments were before us to a large part, except for maybe the community college adjustment. We had the cap before us before we left, and I think the model was, and our understanding was built around those. But let's get some more follow-up information. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
you presented us a huge amount of information, so I apologize if what I'm going to ask about that you've already included and I just didn't absorb it. Some of our institutions are very much constrained by lack of budget and what kind of courses they can offer, courses that they could offer either their current or potential students. For people who are in school, it costs them more to complete their education because they're biding time taking other things because they can't get into the courses that they want. For other people, they just can't even attend. This is true at several institutions, but I've got specific examples. For example, we've heard at OIT, and particularly in my area, at Lane, where they are very constrained, where they're still going through budget reduction mode. So if our institutions, colleges and universities, and I include community colleges in that, if they were able to offer all the courses that people want and need, what impact does this have on the model?
Coach has a brief answer. Nicholson. The questions are a broader one than we normally address, but I can give you a partial solution here. One of the other programs that the Commission has developed is called the OFAX program, or the Oregon Financial Exchange Program. We make this program available to Oregon colleges and universities at no charge, and it expedites students being enrolled at more than one campus at one time. Dozens of consortium agreements that we now have, and they're specifically designed in some cases to take some of those specialized courses to locations where they're not otherwise available. So a community college student can be co-enrolled at a four-year university, or a student at one of our regional universities could be taking a specialized course from another OUS campus on the other side of the state. Similarly, we're getting into independent colleges and universities and working with the nursing consortium and all kinds of things. But as long as there's a home campus and a host campus and the combined total of the students' enrollment meets the minimum for that enrollment level on that financial aid award, then the home campus can package that student's aid with an opportunity grant and a Pell Grant, package that student's aid, the student is able to enroll and get those courses that wouldn't ordinarily be available. And like I said, it's a partial solution. Certainly you need to bring in people from the campuses to talk about course availability, but
I think that's
it's exciting.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. You're enthusiastic about the program. I appreciate that, but we've got a lot of other things we got to do. Other questions?
Thank you very much. I would like you to focus on the experience of private institutions, if you will. I'm in my mind, I'm thinking about the number of students who choose, this is by way of example, to get their teacher training at a private institution. A remarkable number of students do that, in fact. So when we look at the number of opportunity grant recipients increasing overall, and we see that pretty extraordinary percentage, up 80%, 87% at private institutions, what is it that you want us to understand and take away from that piece of information? What should we understand?
And I would ask you to be succinct, if I may, Mr.
Coach Schrader, Senator Gregory. No one program can do anything. One of the unintended consequences of this program is reduced maximum awards for students at the independent college campuses. Now, they get more recipients, and they're getting more dollars overall, but that's where most of the students will be grandfathered. And it is true that the new awards to students on those campuses will be lower than the awards for students were in the past year. And as I said, that is simply an unintended consequence, one of the things that could not be addressed now, perhaps, but down the road.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Further discussion? I'll just make a couple of comments on this. This is a pretty neat program, and you all should be congratulated for at least opening the door to it. It's not perhaps everything to everybody right yet. We've had a lot of people in the education community bite their tongue on a variety of aspects, realizing the overall good is being served, and hopefully over time we will augment this program. Senator Gordley's points about the private schools in the future, I think they're economy willing at some point. There'll be an opportunity to add more private colleges actually to this, more for-profit type schools even that provide an opportunity. Right now there are some that currently get opportunity grants into this program also. But there's and others out there that I think would like to be eligible, and that's a possibility. I'd like to commend the department on their estimator for me. There's only five bloody slides here that I see. That's pretty nice. Yeah, that's almost Kurt Schrader friendly. And I could probably navigate that and get an idea of whether or not I might be able to afford to go to college. I think that's huge. This is they've got it to that level. And then I would urge every one of us put this in one of our newsletters or send it to our colleges or community colleges or universities or frankly, our elementary and elementary and high schools to let people know there's a way that they should be thinking about going to college, and that's 2-year, 4-year, or licensure, you know, whatever you want to do. I think this is a huge opportunity for us. We'll have challenges next session. I went to a steering committee meeting and generally was pretty well received by some of our colleagues around the country, but they did indicate that the caps are a problem. You know, the caps undermine perhaps our credibility as far as being all things. How much does it get to the total minimum wage, and can I really work part-time and do it? I think that's something that we're going to be asked to be addressed financially, again, but it costs money to address those things. The other piece is the family income cap. You know, do we want to address that? What order? I would hope the legislature would play into, with their guidance, if you will, which of these caps stay or go depending on our economic circumstances. The other thing is there's an expected family contribution that the federal government requires, frankly, for FAFSA support for the Pell Grants. We've had to increase ours slightly to make this work within the budget we are allotted. It would be nice to get rid of that so that for the student and the parent, it's all one seamless, if you will, application. It's pretty close to that, but not quite. And that's something we should look at next session. These all cost money, colleagues. These all cost money, and we made a huge investment, and we needed to make investments in other aspects to make sure the universities and community colleges set the capacity to deliver the courses, at least some, that Representative Nathanson was talking about. So we've got to balance that whole education continuum as we make these investments. The other thing we're trying to do right now is market this thing. We want students to know about it. I think, remember, we had that part-time model and took students a couple, 2-3 years to figure it out. At the meeting I attended, they say the Oklahoma, Minnesota, other witchy people said that it could take 3 to 5 years for this to catch hold and become part of the culture, if you will, the state of Oregon. I would hope we push that a little bit. Part of my recommendation I'd like to make is that we, different, perhaps slightly different than was understood at the end of session, that we make sure that there's some outreach money, maybe in the neighborhood of $250,000. They've been frugaling their computer technology budget. Maybe we can use some of that to actually make sure students get the message. We might want to be careful what we ask for, but if it takes 3 to 5 years, I'd like to jumpstart that so that we don't have money languishing and that we have students who are picking it up.
One other thing I'd like to add to your list is some expectation of academic performance. This is a great gift, and others in the state are participating in paying for it. And I think that some expectation that there's an adequate application of due diligence. The idea here is to get more people with credentials or degrees or those things that put them out into the marketplace ready to be productive wage-earning Oregonians and tax-paying Oregonians. But I would like us at some point to think that there is some kind of academic standard, and I don't think it's too much to ask that it be a little bit beyond just limping by.
Further comments? Further discussion? Seeing none, we need a motion to acknowledge receipt of the report and hopefully help them get it out there.
Can we hear from staff?
Oh, yes. Let's hear from BAM. Mr. McGee, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill McGee from Department of Administrative Services. We recommend you acknowledge receipt of the report.
And from our LFO staff.
The Legislative Fiscal Office also recommends that you acknowledge receipt of the report.
Mr. Co-Chair,
I will move that we acknowledge receipt of the report and ask the Department of Administrative Services to reschedule $250,000 of the general fund appropriation already in the agency, not new money, to finance costs associated with developing, operating, and marketing the shared responsibility model.
Further discussion? Objections? Seeing none, we acknowledge receipt of the report as described here. Thank you very much. Good luck. All righty, let's see. We've got Criminal Justice Commission federal funds. Let me look at our... Let's see, you want to do the other public testimony at this point? That's it.
Do we have other people signed up?
Let's reopen the public testimony portion of the hearing. Is there anyone that wants to testify on the bill or another? Please come forward, General.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Lieutenant General Mike Pavel, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. I apologize for not doing this earlier. I got wrapped around the other bill and didn't think to do this, but I would recommend that Senate Bill 5556, that we consider an amendment under Section 4 to create, in line 8, to increase that number to $70 million, opposed to $11.8 million. As we discussed earlier, the second thing I would recommend that the committee, which I've already testified on the previous session, that you pass out Senate Bill 5555, which is the Oregon Military Department's request to dispose of, sell 3.3 acres in Newport, which you've already received testimony on. I want to make sure and get those on the record, sir.
Very good. Thank you, General.
That concludes my testimony. Any questions?
Any questions? Further questions to the General?
Thank you for indulging me.
Thank you very much. Yes, come forward, please. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Bill Medford, and I am not employed by the University of Oregon, although it may look like it. I am just your average athletic supporter, or maybe I should say a supporter of athletic fine. Programs. And I just want to urge you to support the bonds for the University of Oregon Arena. It's an exciting project that is going. I think the University of Oregon obviously has to replace MacArthur Court now or later, and the longer they wait, the more expensive that project will become. The arena requires no state funds. Taxpayer funds will not be used to repay the bonds. Further, the arena will keep the U of O athletic department self-sustaining, which it has been for many years now, and primarily due to the success of the athletic programs down at the University of Oregon, thus ensuring that taxpayer funds, again, will never be used to support the athletic department of the University of Oregon. The arena will provide a huge economic boost to the community, and I would add to the state as a whole, important construction jobs at a time when the economic climate is worsening. If you think about economic impact on just from a successful athletic program, from the beverage you choose at the Ram when the Ducks are in the Elite Eight to a number of different things. I think back to the 70s when our athletic program at the University of Oregon was not very successful and we operated millions of dollars in the red. It wasn't until we turned around the success of those programs that it became a self-sustaining athletic department. And that's to the benefit of the state. It's to the benefit of the community and as a whole. So I would like to, again, urge you to support the bonds for the U of O Arena. $200 million economic impact at no cost to the state, I believe, is a win for everybody. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thanks for taking the time to come here. Anyone else? Seeing none, we'll close the public testimony portion and get our criminal justice folks up. A work session on expenditure limitation increase for grant implementation. Staff, do you have any opening remarks?
Mr. Chairman, the committee, this is a $25,000
request for an increase in the federal funds limitation from the Criminal Justice Commission. You approved the application authority back at the December meeting of the interim committee, and the purpose of the grant is for the development of crime statistics and data collection for directed at tribal communities. So Mr. Prinz is here to answer or give a short description if you wish.
Mr. Chair, that's really it. I don't know if there's anything to add. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Very good. Very good. Questions of
this pretty straightforward request?
No, this is Ways and Means. We don't waste time. Bam, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management, DAS, recommends that the committee approve request for the $25,000 additional federal funds limitation.
Very nice. Seth?
We also recommend that the Senate Bill 5556 reflect the $25,000 increase in the federal funds limitation for the Criminal Justice Commission.
And a motion to that effect? So moved. Objections? Discussion? Or vice versa? Seeing none? So ordered. Thank you. Thanks for waiting. I appreciate that very much. Well, colleagues, I think this is the end of our phase one of today's exciting agenda. And I guess we've got till 6 o'clock. I'd like to have you back here at that point in time. And be our goal, hopefully, not to dwell on the policy too much of that issue. We'll have a lot of time to talk later on, and I hope we deal with mostly the fiscal implications and go forward from there. So we'll recess to Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I would like to point out to the committee that because that bill that we will discuss comes directly from the Transportation Committee in the Senate, the Ways and Means process, this will be the only opportunity for House members to see that bill before it comes to the floor. And without subcommittees, I'd like to ask the co-chairs to please have patience that members may have questions regarding that bill.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I want every member to feel very comfortable asking whatever question they need to, but if we kind of be sensitive, we have one member that's kind of ill that needs to leave, so that would be helpful. Senator Johnson, a question?
Mr. Chair, no question. Just by way of announcements, Senator Whitsitt and I would like to renew our invitation to have members of this panel join us for our rural caucus discussion at 5:30 outside the Senate Democrat Chambers caucus room.
We'll renew our invitation to have you back here by 6 o'clock. Okay, we're recessed then. Or adjourned, I guess, and then we come back and start a new meeting.